In the mid-1980s, following a period of historic financial, cultural, and social growth, Ireland faced a downturn that sent thousands of its young secondary and university graduates out of the country, in a resumption of an emigration pattern that the generation was raised to believe had ended forever. Most of the emigrants left for Great Britain and Europe, but about 10 to 15% of the 360,000 who exited Ireland between 1981 and 1991 came to America. Changes in United States immigration law and the American Irish population itself made it difficult for most of the new young immigrants to enter the country as anything more than tourists. With the appropriate documentation out of their reach, the Irish who wanted to stay in the United States worked under the table in the same menial jobs that generations of Irish who preceded them performed, but this time as overeducated, illegal aliens. In May 1987, a group of passionate, committed, and politicized Irish immigrants and Irish Americans formed an organization called the Irish Immigration Reform Movement, or the IIRM, that in 3 short years changed American immigration law and made thousands of unrestricted visas available to Irish immigrants. This is their story, drawn in part from interviews recorded as part of the Glucksman Ireland House Oral History Project, which are deposited in the Archives of Irish America at Bope's Library, New York University.
The 60s and 70s were a period of great transformation for Ireland.
Linda Dowling Almeida, an historian whose book Irish Immigrants in New York, 1945 to 1995, outlines the experience of Irish immigrants in the 1980s and the role of the IIRM in changing immigration legislation.
You could argue that the country really came out of its primarily agrarian, rural background and became more of a first world urban economy. The beginning in the early 60s with the execution of the Whitaker Papers and Sean Lamass's government, the country underwent a period of investment in its people and in its infrastructure and social programs, so that as a result, that generation born in the 60s and 70s was probably the best educated that the country had had in many generations. More young people were able to go to college. Electricity, television was introduced to the country on a very broad scale. The government set up very attractive economic and tax incentives for foreign business to come in and invest in the country, providing a lot of jobs that the country didn't have up to that point. And as a result, what happened is you have booming marriage rates, booming birth rates. Actually, for the first time in the 70s, in about 100 years of recorded history, more Irish people are coming back into the country than are leaving it. So it was really a period of regeneration and rebirth, and really brought Ireland truly into the 20th century in a way that it had not been previously. So what that meant for the 80s was that you had a lot of young people who were brought up with the belief that they were going to be the new Irish, the new Europeans, that they were going to be a generation that didn't have to emigrate. And you had a high number of them coming out of secondary school and universities. The population in the 80s, I'd say more than 50% of Irish were under the age of 25. So it was a very youthful population. And like I said, educated and more worldly in a way. But in 79-80, the country gets smacked by the worldwide recession and the jump in oil prices. And the economy sort of hits the skids with double-digit inflation and double-digit unemployment. So a lot of the young people who were coming out of school, either secondary or university, thinking they were going to enter this economy that would employ them, they wouldn't have to emigrate, are faced with the fact that they're going to be underemployed or unemployed, that inflation is very high, that their prospects for becoming an adult and entering, you know, this new Irish economy disintegrated.
We were given a great opportunity, I suppose, in hindsight. You know, we were fortunate.
Sean Minahan, Irish engineer and entrepreneur. Sean was the founding member of the IIRM, who migrated with a green card, but recognized the plight of his peers and was the face of the organization in the 1980s.
We were endowed by people's benefit, by the education system and by the hard work of our parents and so on to get us there. So I suppose our expectations, you know, I mean, everybody around this table has been to college, and it's a mellowing time, I suppose. Mm-hmm. It's a maturing time. There were interesting happenings in the Irish political scene that we were watching on the fringes and debating and getting involved, and we were going to take on the world a little bit. So I suppose naivety was also there, to be honest with you. You're still in a cloistered environment, you're protected from the world, and when it comes to the end of fourth year and nobody even wants to interview you, it certainly comes as a shock.
Yeah.
And it did to me. It certainly did. I really didn't know what I was going to do. And of my class at UCC of, I don't know, 90 guys and girls, there were a few girls did civil engineering. The proportions were always too low for me, but that's the way it was when you do engineering. I would say, I won't say 50-50, a few people might have got jobs, a few people did postgrads, and the bulk of the majority split maybe 50-50 or maybe 60-40. Some went east to England and some went west to America.
Really?
And that was it.
Well, actually, I graduated from UCC, and basically you're talking about 1985.
Pat Hurley, with Sean Minahan, was a founding member of the IIRM and a forceful presence behind the scenes. As a third-generation immigrant, actually born in New Zealand, he was acutely aware of the multiple problems faced by immigrants living and working out of status in a foreign country.
That was in the depths of the recession or the depression or whatever you want to call it. I'd actually, having been born in New Zealand, I would have been legal in Australia. So my plan really was to come to New York, because everybody wants to go to New York, right? So come to New York, stay here for about 6 months, okay? And then move on and basically set up a base in Australia. I came over anyway, and that basically was my plan, you know, stick around New York for 6 months, see what it's all about. I had a lot of cousins here too that had, of my generation, who had immigrated legally because their father had been born here. So they were able to come legally, whereas I, being my mother's son, I couldn't come mm-hmm. here legally. I had to basically lie my way into the country. And then I made contact with my old school friends, in particular Sean Minahan, mm-hmm. and you know, we were hanging around the Irish neighbourhoods, Queens, the Bronx, up around Broadway, mm-hmm. Gaelic Park.
Mm-hmm.
And as time went on, we kind of said to ourselves, you know, like, what's going to happen to all these people, like, you know? And nobody really seemed to care. Like, the government were denying that there was even a problem.
Well, Ireland had this classic problem.
Sean Benson, a new Irish immigrant and first executive director of the Emerald Isle Immigration Centre, the social services branch of the IIRM. He was an early member of the group who orchestrated its public relations. As chief media liaison for the IIRM, he was instrumental in its positive press coverage.
That really, it had a huge, there was a number of structural factors that made it almost inevitable that this would happen. I think you had a huge baby boom. You had a huge number of people at this age coming out of college, for one thing. And secondly, the Irish government had wisely made an enormous investment in education, making a third level or university education free. So there's large numbers of people who were going to college, and then large numbers of people coming out of college. However, the rest of the economy, the kind of investment that they needed to make in other areas of infrastructure to attract foreign capital really hadn't been put into place, and they hadn't really yet begun to reap the full benefits of membership of the European Community, even though the European Community was beginning to fund a lot of infrastructure projects in Ireland. So you had this. You had this, plus you had some irresponsibility in the government. They had run up a large foreign debt. They were paying an enormous amount of interest on the debt at the time in the mid-80s. So they had to raise taxes. which further dampened economic activity. So the combination of all those different factors made it very difficult for Ireland to generate enough employment for the people who were coming out of college. And so the Irish were just streaming out of Ireland in a way that they hadn't since the 1950s.
What a lot of them did is they settled in previous in known Irish areas, because they would go where they had heard a relative was, or you know, relative belonged in neighborhoods like Inwood or Woodlawn in the Bronx, Woodside in Queens, so those kinds of communities, and they would live together, sort of dormitory style, typically in buildings that were run by Irish supers, but they tended to stay together amongst themselves as opposed to integrating themselves into the community, into an Irish-American community the way previous generations had. They set themselves apart. Their intention didn't, and there were a couple of reasons for this. Their intentions were not so much to become part of an Irish-American enclave or parish life the way 1950s or 40s immigrants did. They were over there and remaining exclusively amongst themselves socially and in a lot of other ways. A couple of reasons for that. Their status had a lot to do with their fear of really branching out farther into the community.
I was 25. I left graduated college for 1 year, I think, or more. I think I'd spent 6 months in Italy immediately after I graduated. Then I came back to Dublin, looked for work for a little while, and then at one point I think I signed on to the Dáil in Dublin, which was an interesting experience. Everybody was doing it. So then I think in October, I think, of 1985, I came here to New York.
Well, my best friend in college was from Clare.
Lisa Johnston, IRM volunteer and current immigration attorney.
And she lived up here in New Jersey. And we used to spend a lot of time going to the Irish bars in New York. And the Irish bars where the immigrants who came over in the 1980s, the Irish immigrants came over, and we spent a lot of time in the pubs. And so I developed this whole circle of friends who were immigrants themselves. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I came about realizing, hey, this is a big issue for these people. And, I was always sort of politically minded anyway. I went to school in Washington, D.C. I interned for Senator Moynihan for a year and a half. And so I was interested in immigration mm-hmm. as a consequence. And I was interested in it because it was a hook for me for that Irish, that Irish connection that, as I perceived at the time, a legitimate, connection mm-hmm. with Ireland.
I had a social security number, which at the time was all that you needed. And so many people were creative in their, use of a social security number. And none of those were questioned either. So all you needed to do was to come up with 9 digits. And if it started with a 0, sometimes it sounded more authentic.
Well, my first job here was removing asbestos. We got I answered an M, Irish Echo, and there was this like Italian company. I was in Hesco was the name of it, and they had like it was like something kind of like Charles Dickens, like. The whole workforce was either illegal Irish or Polish, right? And it was like you were brought into the work area, like hermetically sealed.
A number of us met somewhere on Broadway, I remember. I was staying out in New Jersey a couple of days beforehand. This is before mobile phones or anything like that. We met somewhere, say Herald Square, I'm not sure. We had our bus map, subways. What's a subway? There's no way we're going down there. Forget that. That wasn't an option, you know. So the bus we knew. So we had our bus map, and we're standing outside, say, Macy's or somewhere on Broadway, and it was the M whatever, M4, let's say, for argument's sake. And the sign said, no standings. so we were afraid to stand at the bus stop because we thought we'd be arrested. That's an example of the naivety. That's a fact. We were afraid to stand. We were backing away from the bus stop, and the people was coming to stand at it, and we expected Kojak or something like that to arrest these people. You know, this is how lost we were in America. You know,
kids, basically kids at the same time, because they were my peers. They were 18 through, you know, 20s. You know, came over to nothing, and they were living in pretty, most of whom were living in not great, you know, digs. You know, you had like what you hear about now when you hear about, oh, you know, there are, you know, 20 Mexicans living in a, you know, 3-bedroom house. Well, it mightn't have been 20 Irish guys, but it was probably 5 or 6 Irish guys or girls sharing, you know, 1 or 2-bedroom apartment with a fold-out couch, because that's what, A, they could afford, and that's what was available. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty, and most of them, like their predecessors, were working in the manual jobs. They were doing, the guys were doing laboring. Some of them had obviously skills, carpentry skills or other skills, but many of them were just laboring. Most of the girls were working as nannies. And these were people who were pretty well educated, mm-hmm. you know.
Well, it was just a wild time, because we would be we were all pretty young and single, and most of us worked at night, and so we would get off work at 1 o'clock in the morning and then go out and come home at 5. So, you know, there's a certain kind of entertainment that's available to you from 1 o'clock in the morning till 5 o'clock. So we would just hang out and so it was a lot of fun.
And so it was a pretty eye-opening thing that, wow, there's this whole generation. And I, like everyone else, sort of thought, well, you're Irish, you can come over. Not that there was any basis for that, but that's sort of the mentality. Nobody cares about. Nobody would care that, you know, 20,000 Irish were coming over, as opposed to you might hear people complain about 20,000, pick any other ethnic nationality mm-hmm. or ethnic background, and that might be the case.
Pat Hurley came over here in, he'll tell you better than I will, probably 86, maybe a year after me. And he came and lived with me for a while, I think. He shared an apartment, and then I'm not sure who he roomed with after that, but he certainly came to me because I was his contact in New York, I suppose. He was illegal. He found it difficult. He had a third level education. He had a degree from UCC, and he had a BA, I think, in European Studies, if memory serves me right. Impossible for him to break into anything in his professional field. And he got a job labouring and removing asbestos from buildings. So that was it. And he'll tell you more. He'll colour in the blanks there. He'll tell you more of the examples there. A good few Irish guys working with him. And they had really, they were, I mean, I can't remember, and he'll fill the details in terms of pay and so on, but in terms of health and safety precautions, they were few and far between. And then a lot of other people that you'd meet in the bars, there were, you know, in the community, there were, health at that stage was a problem for anybody who got sick or health cover, whatever. So every other weekend, there were benefits and benefits for people.
Well, I think their modern expectations had to do with what I said before, that they were raised with the idea that they were going to be, you know, part of this new Europe, the new Europeans, the new Irish, that they were going to be young professionals who didn't have to emigrate, that they were, they grew up, they weren't a colonial population anymore. The previous generations, you know, were, still part of the, their memories, their history was all connected to the struggle of separating from England, of establishing Ireland as its own independent country, of you know, grounding the Constitution, of being part of this great Catholic country. The new Irish, the young people raised in the 60s, the 70s, did not have that same mentality. De Valera died in the 70s. He was part of history. The Republic was a republic. It wasn't part of the 32 counties, so I don't think the young people coming, the new Irish as we understand them, weren't as focused on the troubles as they were on their own economy and their own education.
You used to, if you were a European, you could just say, yes, I'm going to sponsor you, and I'll sign effectively a paper, and you can come over. That all changed, so we moved from this kind of a system to a family-based preference system. So you, there was... what was established was a way for immigrants from other countries to come in through close family connections. You had a gap in immigration from Ireland, 50s till the 80s. So they had no immediate connection, no way to actually come in the country that was family-based. Whereas the Chinese, the South and Central Americans, they tended to have those close connections.
You had, in the 60s and 70s, this period of prosperity in Ireland. So a lot of Irish families who had emigrated in the 40s and 50s returned to Ireland with their families to raise them. So there was a lot of return migration. Immigration as a whole slowed down out of Ireland because of the prosperity. So you have just a trickle of people coming in. And in the meantime, in the U.S., in 1965, there was a change in the immigration law. The first numbers legislation that came into being was initiated in the 1920s, and it had always been based on country of origin. The numbers, the quotas of immigrants allowed for any country from any country was dependent on the status of the population in the 1920s. So there were numbers set that were based on national origin. In 1965, they changed that law to reflect an effort to reunite families, and it was an effort on the part of Congress to expand the immigration laws to include South and Central America and people from Asia. And so what it did was, between the fact that Irish stopped coming to the U.S. or returned to Ireland, and the change in the immigration policy here, by the 1980s, the Irish who wanted to come to America didn't have the family members that would have allowed them to enter the country, without difficulty. So that's what you had. And the young people, because they were desperate for work, didn't want to wait on the immigration line, the queues for the other pathways into the country. It was easier for them. And again, this is before 9/11. It was easier for them to come in and work under the table. And that's what a lot of them did.
How did I become aware of it? I was undocumented. And my friends were undocumented. We were all undocumented. We were all afraid to have a bill arrive in our name, the utility bill. I mean, the stories just went on and on and on about people living underground. So it was quite a... it was something that I was certainly very aware of. You just thought that immigration would be tipped off, or you could be denounced by somebody. Or that was the big fear, that somebody would turn you in.
Well, Brian Donnelly had come up with this problem with Donnelly visas about a year before that. And how he had got that through was, he had identified 36 countries, including Ireland, that, quote, had been adversely affected, unquote. I prefer to use the word discriminated myself, by Ted Kennedy's 1965 Immigration Act. And he basically made the point, well, these countries were adversely affected, we should do something for them. And that's how the Donnelly visas came through. Mm-hmm. And that basically was our premise after that. Well, okay, we got 10,000 Donnelly visas, whatever, but that's not going to cure the problem. The precedent has now been set. These countries were adversely affected by the 65 Act, okay? Now something has to be done for them. And that basically was our premise, mm-hmm. Legalize the Irish, legalize the people that are here now, and set up some kind of permanent immigration quota that would help the Irish, be it specifically for the Irish or be it within the context of a 36 country framework.
Yeah, I got my green card in, I was in July of 87 okay. that I got it.
How many applications did you send in?
I sent in 400.
You did? Mm-hmm. Of your own?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Did you just Xerox them, or did they all have to be original?
No, you could just Xerox them.
We had this kind of concern, look, and I remember having discussions at the time. Okay, Ireland really wasn't going to do that much for us, but at least we got the opportunity of an education.
Yeah.
Okay? I mean, we were both university graduates, which was... it was still kind of more the exception rather than the rule back then. I mean, now I know everybody, you know, gets a chance of a third level education over there, but back then it was like still pretty much like the exception, you know, rather than the rule. And I think it was, you know, I remember feelings being expressed that, you know, well, okay, Ireland really wasn't able to do much for us in one sense, but at least we got the education, and it was a good education too. And we felt that we had to give something back to the country,
mm-hmm.
and our way of doing that would be, you know, let's try and do something here.
Well, I was pretty radicalized just by coming here, and then I was radicalized by what I saw when I got here. About, I just couldn't believe that Irish people were living like this. I mean, in America of all countries, they were living underground, in being terrified, being unable to negotiate for their own rights. It was as if they had just lost their whole notion of, you know, they were free in Ireland, and then they'd come here and they were suddenly, you know, living in this underworld. And the implications of that you could see every day by the way people were living, and a lot of people just completely turned in on the community. In other words, they would just not even socialize with anybody outside the community because of fear. So there was a lot of fear.
Well, let me take this back. I think what happens is that the County Cork Association, there's an effort to create an immigrant a subcommittee to deal with immigration, and a woman by the name of May O'Driscoll is involved, very very active in the Cork Association, and she is named to this this committee, and one thing leads to another, and she gets involved with these two young Irish immigrants, Sean Minahane and Pat Hurley, and before you know it, they create this Irish immigration reform movement. And as May will tell you, you know, if she knew what she was getting into when she started, she never would have continued with it, because it was really, you know, Sisyphus pushing boulder up the hill.
We basically took it to the Cork Association, and I mean, there's one particular meeting, I think the main meeting, 1987, that's kind of like fixed in history as Dubh Éireann started, but I think it was probably a bit more complex than that, from what I can recollect.
Well, I was the recording secretary.
May O'Driscoll, 1960s immigrant, community activist and leader, as well as founding member of the IIRM.
And we had a lot of new immigrants that were illegal. And there was a lot of unhappiness with... they were quite vocal. They felt that, and I remember this one man in particular, he felt that we were doing nothing, that the established community were doing nothing. But I had, my cousin was acting, or was working with some of them, with some of the immigrants. And we had a good few young members. So just out of this discussion, well, my cousin came in with the whole idea of getting the support of the Cork Association and doing something about the situation facing the undocumented. There was thousands at the time. And we had several members, as I said. So out of that meeting grew... The president at the time was Dennis Ford, but he appointed a committee, and it went around the room to different people. No, they couldn't do it, they didn't have the time. So it fell on me to be the first chairman of it at the organization. I said, I don't know anything about immigration. None of us did. So we got the meeting going, and we called up the old, there was an old immigration committee in place, and we met with them. We thought Joe Murphy, who was with the ECHO at the time, said that we should meet with that committee and see if they would come, you know, work with us, and we would have one organization going forward. We wanted them to merge with us and go forward as with a united front. We met with them in Conway's, and they were not interested. They were not impressed. They thought that the young people were just too anxious and they were just too pushy for their own good. And they said no, they weren't interested in joining us. So we went ahead, we sent out the notices, we put ads in the paper, and we had our first meeting. And out of that grew, that was the first meeting of the IIRM, and we just went from there.
You know, the Irish Echo, I'd pick up the Irish Echo, and I just felt that, you know, that why isn't anybody doing anything about this? So when I And I saw a notice in the Echo, I saw a report actually of a meeting from May 20th of 87, and a report of a meeting about a group that was getting together to advocate for immigration. I thought, bingo, you know, I'm going to get involved in that. And so I just called up, and then I got involved from there.
So we agreed we needed a name. There were various names cast around the place. Who was it going to be? Who was it wasn't going to be? And the word movement was, I think, commonly agreed upon that it had to be dynamic, it had to be active, and it had to be aggressive. So the move, that's where the movement came into mm-hmm. play. IIRM, Irish Immigration Reform, I think it just says what it was intended to do. So the name was very evocative, I think, you know, mm-hmm. very dynamic.
Officially, I was like the chairman of the Irish Government Committee, but in reality, I was kind of like wearing several hats. I was like running around. I was involved with the AOH, mobilizing them, mobilizing other Irish Americans, Irish American groups, helping out John Dillon with public relations, being a spokesman for the organization. I mean, basically, my life back then was like IIRM, like 24/7. Job was just something you went to during the day, not for a rest.
The young, you know, the immigrant, the immigrants themselves, May, who was an immigrant from the early 1960s and an established member of the Irish American community, and then people that they reached out to across the various sectors that the Irish had a presence in, including the church, labor, the unions, the embassy, but mostly it was the effort of May and these young people working together sort of 24/7 nonstop for 3 years with the idea that they were going to lobby Congress to effect legislative change to help the plight of the Irish.
We had sort of managed to negotiate among ourselves that Sean would be elected the chairman. And so we wanted to make sure that we came out of the meeting with him as the national chairman. So we had begun to lobby internally to make sure that he wouldn't be opposed. So that was one of the key things that came out of that, to have to establish a single person as the head of the mm-hmm. organization, and then to establish other people as being, you know, as having other responsibilities. But it was critical to have a single person who was the head of the organization to guide, you know, to guide this thing nationally.
Yeah, it was very challenging times. We had a lot of roundtable debate and argument. You will understand in the early days as to what we're going to call it, how's it going to work, who's in charge of what, who's going to do what, all those little things that you have to sort out to get things rolling.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing, I wouldn't say it was perfect. Absolutely not. We were far from a perfect organisation. But the great thing I think was that anybody who was involved, we might have had our own ideas of how to get to the end game, but everybody was going for the same goals. There was broad agreement on the objectives of the organisation, which we at an early stage agreed, because we wanted to rid any dissension within the troops effectively. We wanted a clear statement of goals.
You know, we had a couple of really rough meetings with the Irish government in New York, and they were not at all happy, and Dahi O'Kelly thought we were just a bunch of terrorists, and they were very, very unhappy with us, because we wouldn't go with the script. They would, you know, they couldn't control what we said, and then we would get interviewed in the Irish papers back home, and then would sort of not say what they wanted us to say, which was that the government was doing everything it could to help the undocumented Irish. So we had a bit of fun directing our anger towards the Irish government for the first few months. But then we quickly realized that this might be a lot of fun, but it wasn't really going to get us very far.
Mm.
Because the Irish government really wasn't, we didn't think it had the clout or the interest to actually help us in this. And really what we needed to do was to focus on Washington.
The IIRM had early success by standing up to established institutions in Ireland and the United States. Its refusal to remain quiet, stand aside, and wait to be helped was its best initial asset. As the group and its leadership matured as an organization and came to a better understanding of the battle it faced and the rules of the game it was playing, it learned to work with and not against the powers that be. Having proved that it was serious about reform and committed to the goal, the members were ready to recognize and accept the help offered by the powerful leadership of Irish and Irish Americans in government, labor, the Catholic Church, the law, and the media to get what they wanted.
Our best weapon, really, at the time was that we knew so little, because sometimes when you know so little, you know, if you knew all the obstacles that were ahead of you, you might have done anything. Right? So we knew so little. But I think initially it was just a case of our attitude was like light the explosives and, you know, when all the debris comes down, we'll see where it settles, you know. You know, it was just basically get out there, mobilize Irish America, you know, there was no detailed strategy as such. It was just basically make noise. We knew there was a lot of sympathy out there, but nobody was really doing anything about it. And we knew that sympathy would have to, or that potential would have to be mobilized.
We spent a lot of time early on in the media. Because I think we realized that if we could be on TV and if we could get name recognition, then that people would recognize the brand when we went to Washington. And so we put a little bit of effort into branding ourselves. We put together some posters. And posters were important, and not the handwritten ones, but the printed ones, because when you saw a printed poster on TV, you always think, wow, that must be an organized group, you know. And you just sort of psychologically assume that there's a large organization behind it. So we put a bit of money into buying collateral, into doing some collateral materials, posters, pins, stickers, everything, paraphernalia, just to make us look like a bigger organization. And that was important to create a visual image for cameras when they would come out. They would always focus on the poster, which is Legalize the Irish. Mm-hmm.
The press came to, we didn't look, the media came to us. Hmm. It was amazing. All of a sudden you had Channel 4, Chris Donahue from Channel, he was with Channel 5. Mm-hmm. We had Jim Ryan came to interview us. There was a momentum there. It caught on.
Well, a weekend, we'd say a Saturday, right, would be get up, probably get a phone call from John Dillon, oh yeah, CNN want to interview an illegal Irish immigrant, because like the media had this fascination like rather an illegal Irish immigrant, impossible, it couldn't be, you know. So very much in demand, like the illegal Irish immigrant, you know. So and then another thing that had great sex appeal too was to have an illegal Irish immigrant who's a spokesman for this political organization on camera, who's basically like daring the world, come and get me.
One St. Patrick's Day, we handed out 5,000 stickers on Fifth Avenue, and everywhere you looked, it looked like everybody was wearing a Legalize the Irish sticker. You just couldn't go anywhere, and people noticed that. I mean, once when we went to, we had a Schumer was the Grand Marshal of a parade in Brooklyn in Rockaway, so. We knew that ABC was coming out. ABC TV, the network news, were coming out and doing a story on the undocumented Irish. And so we only had a really small group marching, but we brought tons of posters. And we gave a poster to everybody who was marching. And Schumer saw this. He saw it like, can you imagine, you're seeing, you know, line after line of people marching with this poster which says Legalize the Irish, and he's leading this parade and he's watching all these people going by. But the parade turns, and so like before people came in front of the viewing stand, we were just handing out the posters. They didn't have the posters until they just came by the viewing stand. So we wanted Schumer to see that, because we knew that he was a key politician.
So one of the things that we did was try to say, look, this bill that we're looking for is a way to try to open up the door again, effectively, let people come in from Ireland, and it ended up being, you know, with the Schumer program, other, you know, Eastern European countries and European countries in whole. We tried to get the stream going so that they could, the Irish could take advantage of this system that's already existing by having these close connections.
They sought out, and I think they were the guys who recommended Harris Miller, who proved to be a canny, wily, and in fairness, I'd say, for a Jewish-American guy, motivated supporter of our cause, and got really involved and was a fantastic asset. I mean, and again, in hindsight, even though a lot of people disagreed, we should, you know, the constant debate in committees and organizations, we should be sending postcards, we should be having marches down Fifth Avenue. I was of the view, gradually, and I suppose with the assistance of the guys in Chicago, Washington's where it's at. We've got to be working the inside track as well.
We decided to hire a lobbyist, Harris Miller. And the first thing we asked him to do was to lay out what's the process of getting getting a bill through Congress. And so he put together this three-page process that outlined how things actually worked. You know, that a bill goes from a committee, a subcommittee, then it's voted on by a committee, and then it goes to the floor. And then along the way, there's a rules committee who set the rules of debate around a bill when it's being put up on the floor. And then there's the and the rules committee, we understood later, was going to be very, very critical because, but anyway, Harris Miller set out all of this information for us about how a bill goes through Congress. So once we got that, then we sort of understood who we needed to target. And so we decided to, it was easy because you had to target people, first of all, on the immigration subcommittee, and then you target people on the judiciary committee, the key people on the judiciary committee, and then you target people on the rules committee. And fortunately, it was only one person. It was Joe Moakley, who was the head of the rules committee in the House. And the rules committee decides when things are when things happen. It's a critical procedural part of Congress, and he also sets the rules on the debate and the questions that are allowed and amendments that are allowed on a bill, which was critical because we knew that we had to keep whatever amendments that we'd managed to get through the subcommittee and through the judiciary committee, we had to make sure that they managed to get through the floor without anybody making an amendment to remove our provisions. So we worked on Joe Moakley, and so we figured out that in all of the people in Congress, there was only four or five people that we actually needed to work on. And that made the task a lot easier.
Brendan was, you know, Brendan knew my predicament, so he was trying to help me out. So we got down to the bar. He pushed me in beside Danley, right? Mm-hmm. So we all sat down. Remember, there was a gentleman, an Irish-Australian guy as well from the Australian embassy, you know? And we sat down and we were talking with him, and you know, the beer was flowing and everything, and I got talking to Donnelly, and he said, he basically asked me, like, well, I presume you have a green card, because I see your name in the paper and everything, right? And I had heard that he had reacted very badly to illegals, like he didn't like to be put in a position where it was a one-on-one with illegals, because basically he was... By doing that, you're kind of like, here he is like a representative of the people, and he's basically right. Meeting with a lawbreaker, right? So I timidly said, no, I don't have a green card, you know, expecting all hell to break loose, you know. So Donnie then started telling me about his parents and from Roscommon, and he kind of had a sneaking suspicion going up that they weren't legal either, right? So we were talking away, and then I explained the situation about, you know, how I had got called for one of your visas, but I couldn't take it up now because I was a New Zealander, you know, as far as the State Department are concerned. So I'm like, don't worry, you know, I'll take care of you, don't worry. You know, I thought it was just like, kind of like the beer talk,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
So fine, it was grand. We left the bar, I remember we all went our separate ways and got back to New York. And the bill was being voted on. It was in September. The bill was being debated in the House. And I get this, I remember one day at lunchtime, I get this friend called from Brendan Scannell at the embassy in Washington. And he says to me, Listen, remember when we were drinking with Donnelly there in the Dubliner during the summer? I said, yeah. Remember you were telling him something about you had called for the Donnelly visa, but you can't take it up now because you're a New Zealander? I said, yeah. Well, listen, can you put that in paper again? Because his office called me up and asked me about that. He had been reminded about that. He said, can you put on paper again exactly what the situation is? Fax it down to me and I'll get it over to his people. Right, so, fine, I wrote it down, wrote down what the actual situation was. Faxed it down to Scanlon. He went to lunch with, I think, Donnelly, gave it to Donnelly, and then Donnelly put on some amendment to the bill as it was going through the House, which basically said, if you strip away the legalese, basically said, if you were called for a Donnelly visa and weren't eligible, now you're eligible.
As it went down through the process, even in the last 48 hours before the bill actually went through, it was such, relatively high drama, because the bill as it went to the floor actually was voted down, and then had to be resurrected by the Rules Committee. Then Joe Moakley just brought it back to the floor again for a second vote the next day. I mean, that doesn't happen often.
Mm-mm.
That the bill went down. I mean, Harris Miller called us. We were out celebrating in Queens, because the bill is we got the bill to the floor, and we were like, yeah. And then he called us and said the bill went down.
God.
And we were just like, Jesus, what are we gonna do? And then initial thought was, let's just go down to Washington. And we quickly dismissed that, and we decided, okay, let's just go home and go to sleep and wake up tomorrow morning early and get on the phone. So we got on the phone, we got Flannelly involved and others, and we got a lot of people calling down in Congress.
Adrian Flannelly.
Yeah. But unbeknownst to us at the time, Ted Kennedy was on the phone to about 50 members of Congress.
No kidding.
Yeah. And he told them to get their act together and vote for this goddamn thing.
The 1990 Immigration Act that the IRM fought to pass included a diversity transition program that allocated 40,000 visas per year for 3 years, beginning in 1992, to nationals designated as adversely affected by the 1965 Immigration Act. In addition, Irish nationals were guaranteed 40% of the 40,000 visas each year. The bill basically reserved 48,000 non-preference visas to the Irish over a three-year period.
After 4 years of 24/7 operation, total commitment, most of us, I would say all of us, were burnt out, and anything that came along and basically gave us green cards was welcome. And in fairness, considering how we had started, considering our potential, it was a major achievement.
We've been brought up pretty confident in Ireland. And I think that was the difference, was that we were brought up to believe that we could actually do things. And so we brought that self-confidence out here. And, Minahan is an engineer. I had my own background. We weren't brought up to dig potatoes. We were brought up to do something better. And so we didn't feel like we had to, excuse ourselves to anybody when we came here. So, and also, there was a lot of bonding between us, and that also reinforced our self-confidence. So even though we were kind of young, we bounced an awful lot of ideas off each other. And we all had always been interested. All of us had all been interested in politics. And, we just sort of knew, we just felt that this was the way that we just had a really, really narrow vision. And we knew that the solution to our problem was to get federal law changed.
I think I would have been more scientific in my approach, armed with the knowledge I have now, if I had it back then, we would have been more scientific in our approach to, securing some kind of legislative relief, But considering that we were basically a bunch of amateurs operating on a shoestring budget, I think we, you know, did fairly remarkably well, you know.
In the 25 years since the founding of the Irish immigration reform movement, Ireland rebounded economically while continuing to experience profound cultural and social change. Scandals in the Catholic Church rocked the country and left the faithful disillusioned and angry, so that by the mid-1990s, Ireland was more secular than religious, identified as one of the most successful countries in the European Union, and declared one of the most desirable places to live in the world. For the first time in its history, it became an immigrant destination rather than an exporter of people. When the bubble burst in 2008, banks failed, real estate crashed, leaving homes underwater and thousands out of work again. The Central Statistics Office in Ireland reported that in 2010, about 65,000 people left the country, an outflow that had not been seen in at least two decades. Young Irish were again boarding planes to find jobs and lives abroad. This time, however, the United States did not prove to be as popular an immigrant choice as it had in the past. Things were not good in America either, following Wall Street failures, bank closings, and a housing slump that initiated a prolonged recession with poor employment opportunities. Combined with post-9/11 immigration restrictions, the United States was not a friendly destination for Irish immigrants. And early evidence suggests that Australia and Canada have instead become targets for Ireland's most recent exodus. The work of the Irish immigration reform movement could not help the generation that followed it, but its significance is not dulled as a consequence. Upon reflection, it remains a remarkable group, powered by its members' resourcefulness and drive, as well as its wisdom in tapping the latent power of the Irish-American community to come to the aid of a new generation of immigrants.
Yeah, I mean, it's a shame the book has to be written.
Yes.
Because it was such an achievement in such a short time frame by people who were inexperienced. It's amazing what can be done by when you're innocent and ignorant.
Take that in the wrong way.
I know, ignorant, absolutely. We were ignorant.
Because
I remember when they said to me, I know nothing about immigration. They said, what? None of us know anything. And if we ever knew what was involved, we would never have gotten involved. We would never have taken on this huge project to say that, yeah, we're going to change the laws of the United States.